This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Politicians with a lot of money, students with a lot of debt, and company boards of directors without a whole lot of women. Just another day in American capitalism, I guess. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Tuesday, the 24th of June, my calendar says. Good to have you here, as always. We interrupt this regularly scheduled broadcast to bring you news of an obscure yet somehow in the spotlight federal bureaucracy. The Export-Import Bank, the EXIM Bank to the cognoscenti, is a government agency that finances exports. It's been around for a long time, since 1934, in fact. But if incoming House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy has his way, this is about as far as it goes. McCarthy said this past weekend he doesn't want to renew the bank's charter when it comes due this fall. Could be replaced by a private bank, he says. So, in the spirit of explanatory journalism, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has this EXIM primer.
David Eichert is a vice president of Air Tractor in Olney, Texas.
We make agricultural airplanes, crop dusters, if you will, and forestry firefighting planes.
So you can imagine that a lot of his customers, 50% actually, are all over the world. And sometimes that causes problems. A farmer in Brazil, for example, told him,
"We really like your plane, we want to buy your plane, but we need five-year financing."
Normally, a business might go to a bank. But U.S. banks are sometimes leery about loaning abroad, and banking systems abroad are sometimes just not robust enough to make these kinds of loans.
No commercial bank in the United States, or in Brazil, as that matter, because I have knocked on doors in Brazil, would make that loan to that farmer for a crop duster for $800,000 for 5 years. It is just not going to happen.
Enter the Export-Import Bank.
We exist to fill in those gaps when needed.
This is Fred Hochberg, president of the Export-Import Bank of the United States.
To make sure that trade flows and we keep supporting more jobs here at home. We do insurance and we do loans, both guaranteed and direct.
Offering insurance on a loan makes banks more likely to make a loan. That's what happened in the crop duster example. And when the EXIM Bank makes a loan itself, it's doing it so foreign buyers can buy U.S. products.
Give you an example. In India, in the last 12 months, 30% of all exports that went to India, we financed. Because the banking system is not as strong there.
And this is actually what a lot of exporters try to do. There are 59 other export-import banks out there all trying to make their country's products sell.
We don't want to lose a sale because there's no financing, and then those sales go to a foreign competitor.
So really, export-import banks are just one weapon in the battle over international trade. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There was a big report out on student loan debt today. Big as in the data was kind of interesting and potentially important, and big because the number that gets batted around in the press about total student loan debt is also big, $1 trillion or more. The research comes from the Brookings Institution, a Washington think tank, and it says the student loan crisis, while bad, may not be that bad. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
The findings from the Brookings report are so startling, even co-author Matthew Chingos didn't believe them at first.
And my first reaction when we ran these data was, this has to be wrong.
But Chingos rechecked the data until he was satisfied with his conclusions. Among them, monthly student loan payments have stayed at 3-4% of a borrower's monthly income since 1992. Chingos also says in 2010, only 2% of young households owed more than $100,000. And
there don't seem to be more of those than there used to be. If anything, there are less.
But Chingos says more people have student loans because more students are going to college. The people he really worries about, those who never got their degree. People like Rhonda Wanzer. She's 48 and has a good job with the federal government without a degree. But she still owes about $28,000.
I am trying to devise a plan where I can, you know, pay it off at least before I can retire. I can retire in about 16, 20 years.
Pachinkos insists Wanser isn't typical. He says most student loan borrowers do finish college and eventually pay off their loans. His study has its critics, who say his data, which is from the Federal Reserve, is too limited, doesn't count everyone, and is old. Pachinkos says the Fed data is the best there is for this kind of research, and he'll take a close look at new data when it comes out in the next 6 months or so. Other researchers using Education Department data agree with Pachinkos' conclusions. Sandy Baum is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. She says the real culprit here is high college tuition.
Tuition has certainly gone up rapidly, and particularly in recent years in public colleges and universities.
That is something everyone can agree on. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Well, into each life a little rain must fall, I suppose, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Google released demographic data for its employees a month or so ago, maybe a little more, actually. But to absolutely nobody's surprise, the company is very white and very male. On the other hand, though, Google does have something a lot of companies don't, diversity-wise: 3 women on its 10-member board of directors. Research is pretty clear that board diversity does actually make a difference to bottom lines. What's less clear is why most companies aren't in any rush to change the status quo. One recent study showed parity in the boardroom will arrive by the year 2042. Ashley Miltide has our story.
For the last few years, Molly Jarrow has been keeping tabs on how many female board members companies have. Jarrow is co-founder of the nonprofit 2020 Women on Boards. She says some top companies have women in 20% or more of board seats, but most are way below that number.
Those are the companies that are truly relying on their network, and most of the male CEOs know men like themselves, and those are the people they rely on.
And that's how the cycle of men on boards continues. It's a cycle large investment funds like CalPERS are trying to break. Ann Simpson is senior portfolio manager at CalPERS, California's employee pension fund. This spring, it worked to bring a shareholder resolution against Urban Outfitters. CalPERS pressed the fashion retailer to put more women and minorities in its boardroom. Urban Outfitters' main market? Young women.
And until last year, this was a company which had an all-male board, mostly over 60 years old. And for ours, this really isn't a board which has got the range of diverse experience and talent to really secure the company for the long term.
Last year, after a previous shareholder resolution, Urban Outfitters agreed to put a woman on its board. Simpson says initially, fund managers were delighted.
However, on further examination, we realised that the person that they'd found was conveniently the wife of the chief executive.
The company, she says, made no effort to look further afield. Technology executive Heidi Roizen is trying to encourage companies to do just that. Whenever she hears a CEO say he can't find any good women, she whips out her list of qualified candidates.
I joke about, you know, having binders of women. I have more binders of women than Mitt Romney.
Roizen is a partner at Silicon Valley venture capital firm DFJ. She served on more than 30 boards during the last 2 decades, and it can be a little lonely.
You know, if I think about the boards I'm currently on, TiVo, I'm the only woman. Eventful, there's another woman, Esther Dyson. Share This, I'm the only woman. X Time, I'm the only woman.
It's not surprising she sits on so many corporate boards. A recent study found women and minorities are far likelier than white men to be on lots of boards at once. Ann Simpson of CalPERS says that's because companies are still nervous about working with lesser-known candidates. They stick with women they know are good. CalPERS wants companies to limit the time board members can spend on the job.
Because if we don't start creating opportunities for new people to come in, then we won't achieve diversity, certainly not in my lifetime.
As for CalPERS' effort to get Urban Outfitters to put more women and minorities on the board, it failed. Most shareholders voted no. Molly Jarrow says shareholders worry about rocking the boat, but she says there's another reason things don't change: apathy.
Most stockholders don't even vote their proxies. In fact, they don't even open those envelopes to look at the board composition or to see what resolutions are up and need voting on.
Jarrow says if you care about who is making the decisions at companies you have a stake in, first step, open that envelope. then vote. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
There's a case to be made that Hillary Clinton ought to just stop talking. And yes, I know we're still 2 years out from the presidential election in which she is widely expected to be a candidate. But really, she's not doing herself any favors talking about and talking about some more how she and her husband were dead broke when they were leaving the White House. Talking about wealth as a politician when you have huge pots of money can be tricky. And this is an equal opportunity reality, by the way. See also Romney come amit 2 years ago. It is not, however, something new. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
The economic disparity between the common man and the politician is as old as democracy itself. In 64 BC, when Cicero was running for consul of the Roman Republic, his brother is believed to have written what could be called the first electioneering handbook.
That handbook of electioneering says that you have to pretend on this day that you're the equal of everyone else.
Alex Gurevich teaches political science at Brown. He says the politicians who are best at pretending to be equal are the ones who avoid talking about their own wealth at all and turn the focus to other people's money. FDR was a good example.
He was effective at stirring up populist support by talking about the wealth of others.
Another strategy, if you do come from humble beginnings, is to emphasize your upbringing, like John Edwards, who campaigned not as a wealthy attorney, but as the son of a mill worker.
My father worked in this mill and others like it for 30 years. I worked here when I was young.
You know, one question that I think people should be asking is, does it matter the politicians are so much better off than the people they're supposed to represent?
Nicholas Carnes is the author of White Collar Government, The Hidden Roles of Class in Economic Policymaking.
And what I find is that, yeah, it really does matter. Politicians who don't have experience doing working class jobs really do think differently, vote differently, introduce different kinds of legislation than the few politicians who know what it's like to be a blue-collar worker.
Carnes says that the average member of Congress spent 1.5% of his pre-Congress career working in manual labor or service industry jobs, a percentage that has changed little over the last 100 years. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coming up, when a ball game isn't really a ball game.
There were ads for Yankees cologne and various other items that maybe make no sense outside of, you know, the baseball universe or really any universe.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 0.7% today. That's 119 points, closed at 16,818. The NASDAQ retreated 0.4%, 18 points. Finished at 43.50. The S&P 500 gave back 0.6%. That is 12 points. Closed at 19.49. Iraq gave energy companies the jitters. Occidental Petroleum spilled 3.5% today. Marathon Petroleum off nearly 3%. Financials did the slip and slide as well. Morgan Stanley reversed 1.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase raised 1.33% today. On the upside, Vertex Pharmaceuticals soared 40%, 40% on news that its cystic fibrosis drugs has performed well in clinical trials. Chipmaker Micron Technology picked up nearly 4% today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. Are folks prepping for summer? The Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for May, stuff like lawn and garden equipment, or a computer for you indoor types. The House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology discusses the future of human space exploration. And the annual Smithsonian Folklife Festival opens on the National Mall in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The coin of the realm in social media, at least one of the most important coins of the realm for social media companies, is the user base. How many users Facebook or Twitter or WhatsApp have? grow it or die. LinkedIn reported not too long ago that the growth of its user base has started to slow. But LinkedIn is supposed to provide a service, a meeting place of sorts for job seekers and recruiters. So if you look at it that way, instead of just at its 300 million users, how well does LinkedIn actually work? Sally Herships has that story.
Job hunting can feel like you're dropping your resumes into a black hole. And what about your LinkedIn profile? Is anyone actually reading it or your updates? Turns out, yes. Someone, many someones, are searching LinkedIn potentially for you. Do I even have a search like this?
I don't believe that you do. I think you have to be a member of LinkedIn Recruiter.
This is pretty robust looking. Dwight Scott is a recruiter with ExecuSearch in New York, and there is indeed a version of LinkedIn just for recruiters.
80% of today's working professionals aren't actively looking for a new job.
Scott doesn't spend a lot of time reviewing resumes of applicants. Instead, he's searching LinkedIn for potential hires.
Degrees, field of study, industry, what groups have they joined? Are you interested in interviewing people that have joined Deadheads with Ties? Well, it's right there.
Wait, that's a group?
That is a group.
What about, I talked to a couple of folks from big executive, you know, C-level search firms who were like horrified. They were like, we would never use LinkedIn. Are they telling the truth?
No. I don't think that they are. I think everybody uses LinkedIn.
So what does this mean for people who belong to LinkedIn because they're looking for a job or because they have a vague understanding that belonging to the site might somehow help them? I heard from a lot of workers who said they found jobs through the site, both by making new contacts and being contacted by recruiters. Claudine Halpern worked in management consulting for 35 years. She says she's used LinkedIn to get a lot of projects.
It's a tool. It's not A+. Nothing's A+ without the work that you do around it.
Halpern says anyone looking for a job needs to have a strategy, like updating their LinkedIn profile on a regular basis so it gets in front of a lot of eyes, like Dwight Scott's.
You can't put out a profile and ignore it. You got to keep it rolling. It's like a snowball. You got to keep it rolling and rolling and rolling, and you got to keep it growing. Otherwise, it doesn't work for you.
Peter Capelli teaches human resources at Wharton. He says employers and recruiters have to be careful to see through all the white noise on the site. They have a tendency to look at your current title and see if it matches the job that needs to be filled. He says this can mean ignoring creative hires and potential. At the same time, he says LinkedIn makes it easy to game the system. Did you see how I wrote on my profile that I am an amazing reporter? Capelli says no one is going to post a bad recommendation on the site.
So everybody gets good references and everything is glowing, so at some point it's kind of useless.
I think my mom actually endorsed some of my skills on LinkedIn.
Good. I hope she gave you a good reference.
Mom, thanks for endorsing me. But Capelli says it's so easy to click those buttons, it's not going to help me get a job. LinkedIn says it's used for a lot more than jobs, like marketing and education. And it says it's impossible to track how many jobs are filled through its site. But Halpern says you'll have a better chance of getting noticed if you're a joiner and an updater, providing even more information for LinkedIn, which is what the site promises its paying customers, recruiters. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
A brief sampling of the baseball calendar today has the White Sox in Baltimore playing the Orioles, the Yanks in Toronto against the Blue Jays, and Cleveland in Arizona playing the Diamondbacks. Point being, Major League Baseball is a sport played on a national stage, international actually, which makes getting from stadium to stadium to visit all 30 parks, let alone doing it in 30 days, a logistical, shall we say, challenge. Best undertaken by the young and not smart enough to know any better, Ben Blatt and Eric Brewster by name. They began their pilgrimage on June the 1st, 2013, and wound up with a book called I Don't Care If We Never Get Back, 30 Games in 30 Days on the Best Worst Baseball Road Trip Ever. Guys, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Ben, since this was your idea, I'm going to ask you to get started, and I need you to lay out the ground rules for this thing, which seem to me to be the essence of the entire enterprise.
Right. So I was in this club in college. I was very nerdy, very sports-centric. Essentially, it was a club where all we did was Moneyball-type studies, purely out of fun. And one of the crazier ideas I had at one point in my college career was to find the optimal way to visit all 30 ballparks. So we were driving from city to city, going to the first pitch to the last pitch, you know, pure baseball road trip.
Okay, now, Eric, here's the part of this entire thing that I honestly can't quite wrap my brain around yet. Not only do you not like baseball, you almost actively dislike baseball, and yet here you sign up for what in essence is hell, right?
Yeah, about a year later, I'm still trying to wrap my brain around that. One of my favorite moments was when we drove by the Grand Canyon, but not to it, which was pretty emblematic of the experience overall.
This thing starts, the book starts, the prologue actually. It's not chronologically the first sequence, but the prologue is you guys mid-trip somewhere, a pitcher has been hit by a batted ball, the entire stadium is quiet and hushed. It's, you know, 30,000 people watching this guy, and an inning or two later, the crowd is still quiet, and then the team, like, strikes out its 10th batter in a row, and the scoreboard lights up, and it says, everything's going to be okay, everybody gets a free Papa John's pizza because we had the 10th strikeout. And you're like, oh, yeah, no, baseball's a business, man.
Yeah, it was one of the most surprisingly reinforced things we witnessed over the course of the trip. You just got to feel how much this was a giant conglomeration of companies that are there to drive a profit, and that's what every minute of every game is about from that perspective. And that became comically apparent after seeing game after game after game and all of the little giveaways and in stadium games they would have almost identical replicas everywhere you went.
Which one of you, and I apologize for not being able to remember, which one of you spent at least an inning or two in Yankee Stadium counting the number of advertisements on stadium surfaces?
As the numbers guy, that would be me, Ben. You know, I think in Yankee Stadium, I forget the exact number off the top of my head.
I think it was 46.
46 were just the print advertisements I can see from my seat. You know, Wrigley Field in Chicago is the one stadium that has a ban on these. So for the most part, there's absolutely none that you can see from your seat. But every other stadium, you know, Yankee Stadium is a bit worse. There were ads for Yankees cologne and various other items that maybe make no sense outside of, you know, the baseball universe or really any universe. But, you know, every stadium you go to, the whole wall is covered in ads. And it's fun to see the variation from stadium to stadium and city to city.
How sick and tired are you guys of Take Me Out to the Ballgame?
I would go into anaphylactic shock at this point, I think, if I heard it again. We just devolved into just hours-long arguments about the lyrics themselves. We were so overwhelmed by that song on repeat.
Yeah, the confusing thing about that song that we had quite probably an entire game's length debate about was in some ballpark that sung I Don't Care If We Never Get Back, and in other ballparks it's I Don't Care If We Ever Get Back, and also this game
No, it's ever. It's ever. I Don't Care If We Ever, Never.
Oh, so you think,
I don't know.
We kept track because what else are we going to do with our lives? And at 14 out of the 30 parks, they say Never Get Back.
I Don't Care If I... No, it's never. Sorry, I was right. It's never. Yeah.
And, you know, the close reading of this song really, really got to us and made us go insane among many other things.
You guys had way too much time on your hands. It's a book called I Don't Care If We Never Get Back, 30 Games in 30 Days on the Best Worst Baseball Road Trip Ever. Ben Blatt and Eric Brewster are the two guys who did the driving. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
Here's a survey question for you. Have you noticed that retailers and just about every other business, for that matter, are sending you lots of surveys? Did we meet your expectations? How likely are you to recommend us? Were you happy with the packaging? That kind of thing. Commentator Beth Tytel has an inbox full of pleas for her opinion.
I guess I should be happy that JetBlue and American Express and Dividend Miles and my kid's pediatrician and my dentist and the Hertz Gold program, which I signed up for but never even used, care about what I think. But on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being, I am respected, hear me roar, and 5 being, I feel ignored, I'm all the way at 10, as in, what kind of sucker do you take me for? Apparently, it's not enough that I give these businesses my money. Now I've got to do their market research, too, for free. Oh, excuse me, to be fair, sometimes they do offer a tiny payment or the remote chance of winning a prize, both of which are obviously designed to get me to use the product or service again, which in turn will trigger another survey. I don't see a living in it. but the surveys are gaining on me. The country's best-known survey platform, SurveyMonkey, is now processing survey responses at the rate of 2.2 million per day, up from 1 million a day in January 2013. And it recently introduced a mobile app, meaning clients don't even have to be at their desks to create and zap off a survey. Look out! Here comes one now! We have the internet to thank for this, of course. Online technology makes it less expensive and easier to send surveys than in the past, when data analysis took longer and at least the cost of stamps were a deterrent. But you know, there can be one thing worse than taking a survey. Not taking it. At my son's local GameStop, the employees are so nice and make such heartfelt appeals for me to fill out the customer experience survey that I feel actual remorse when I don't. Survey guilt. Who would have thought it possible?
Beth Tytel is a reporter at the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the sort of business trivia that, I don't know, maybe only the host of a business program can really love. It's a map from a cloud computing company called Broadview Networks that lists the biggest company by revenue in each of the 50 of these United States. We've got a link on our website, so you can have a look for yourselves. It's marketplace.org, of course. In the meanwhile, here are a couple of my favorites. In Vermont, the Keurig Green Mountain Company of coffee fame. Utah, the Huntsman Corporation of John Huntsman, 2012 presidential candidate's family fame. And Nebraska. Come on. Any guesses? Omaha? Anyone? Berkshire Hathaway of Warren Buffett fame. All right, there you go. That is Marketplace on this, what, Tuesday, I guess it is. Today, the Dow off 0.7%, 119 points. The NASDAQ gave back 0.4%, 18 points. The S&P 500 lost 0.6%. That is 12 points. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.